Bro, you ever heard of Gunkata?
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Underrated Podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Derek McDuff, of the Undercast Company. And joining me, as always, are Ariel Ortiz.
Hello.
And Alan Torres.
Hey, what's up, everybody?
And joining us this week, we have a special guest, Marcel from the Real Chums podcast. How is it going, Marcel?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Derek and team. Really appreciate it. We're having a good time so far.
Yeah. Excited to have you here. I got to go talk about one of my favorite movies ever, Princess Mononoke, on your show.
It was awesome, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, I had a really good time. I had a really good time with that. But, you know, for our listeners out there who may not know, we cover underrated movies here, as the name would imply, underappreciated movies, ones that have slipped under the radar. And for your pick, Marcel, you chose Equilibrium, a 2002 film directed and written by Kurt Wimmer, starring Christian Bale, Emily Watson, and Taye Diggs. If you want to start us off here, Marcel, why was this? You gave us a few underrated picks. We mulled them over a little bit, but we kind of came to the consensus talking about Equilibrium here. So why was this one that you wanted to talk about?
This is one of those movies that went under the radar for me. It came out in 2002, and I didn't see it until like 2006-ish, I want to say. And like my brother showed it to me. He's like, here's how he pitched it to me. He's like, it's like The Matrix, but not. And I was like, okay. And then like I saw the trailer and the marketing for it, and they very heavily like almost marketed it as like like The Matrix, but more deeper in thought and whatever. But I love this movie just because I never heard of it. It was 2002. It went under the radar. I saw it, and I was that guy who like would tell all my buddies about it. And I was like, have you guys heard of Equilibrium? It came out like 4 years ago. They're like, no, never. And everyone was talking about Christian Bale and him being Batman and all that stuff. I'm like, oh, no, you have to watch him in Equilibrium first. And so like it just became this movie that like I was always like shooting, like just telling everyone about it. I am also like a sucker for like dystopian societies, and this movie was it. And I also saw this like a year after my freshman high school teacher had us read Fahrenheit 451, right?
Exactly.
Barry's book. Yeah. And so like this movie was like that, but with guns and like action sequences. Mm-hmm. And it was like, this is it. I love this movie. And not enough people talk about it. And it's just not in the zeitgeist. So that's why I chose this movie.
Yeah. No, exactly. For it, building off of that, that is the exact way that I was introduced to this movie. We were actually shown it in class after reading Fahrenheit 451, which is one of my favorite books as well. I really love dystopian books and stories, except for, which this kind of loosely based off of, and it is a classic, I will give it that, of 1984. I don't really like 1984, actually. I love Fahrenheit 451 a lot more, and it's because of the reason that Fahrenheit 451 and then this movie is because of that, what a dystopian book should be, a warning, but then also a look at like hope that it can be changed kind of thing, which 1984 does not give that ending at all. So yeah, this movie as well, like I'm Christian Bale is my Batman. I love him to death, and so coming off of that, and like this was like about the time of Batman Begins is when I watched this movie in class, and I just love this movie. The action of it is just the whole Gunkata of it all is such a unique concept, and it's definitely like my brother, like I was showing, like, do you want to see, when I was rewatching it for this episode, I was like, do you want to see the most epic gun like court sequences that you will ever see in a movie? And he's like, yeah, like, what is it, like how like John Wick, like that? And I'm like, no, this is Gunkata. It's stuff like that. And I really love this movie. It's of course you gotta have the Sean Bean dying in a movie element. It's got that, so it checks that book, it checks that bucket, I mean that checklist of cinema. And that too is the whole while it's a very well used trope in a lot of different dystopian medias of like this, essentially like the regulation of emotions and things like that, which a little sidebar, because I am like in regulatory affairs, that's my day job. And so the medication wearing off within a few hours, not great medication. Like, it's not effective at all. Like, which I guess also like plays into the whole like emotions can't be, you know, beaten. Like, you know, they'll always come through and stuff like that. So kind of playing off that. But from like, it would not pass any FDA regulations because it does not work. It's not effective. But yeah, like this whole, I've always loved this whole, that type of dystopian of like essentially like the regulation of emotions. You have elements of that in like Divergent a bit, and then also like there's like in video games of like, there's one where it's like they take like joy. I can't remember it. It was just like a very recent indie game, but I really love that trope. I and so this movie has always been like a very like niche favorite of mine, and then yeah, and I also like Taze Diggs, and that was like insane to see his face get sliced. It always gets me.
No, yeah, I think you're right. I think like I'm a sucker for like a good dystopian movie where the focus is like suppressing your emotions, right? And it, I think it's executed so uniquely in the sense that like I love that the movie starts like that first scene when you see Sean Bean and Christian Bale go in, and like he just takes out that group of rebels. I can't remember what they call them officially.
Yeah, like revolutionaries. Yeah,
the revolutionaries, right? But then like as the movie progresses and as he stops taking Prosium, the medication, the fight sequence, like the violence increases, right? Like we as an audience are becoming more aware of the violence, whereas at the beginning, like him, it wasn't fading. Like it just wasn't, like there was no blood and like it was all in the dark. We weren't having any emotion to it. And then as he stops taking the medication, we're in that ride with him, and we start seeing the blood and the holes and the slashing of the face, which is so iconic. But yeah, I love when it's done, when it's executed that way, right? I think there, when I watched this, V for Vendetta was coming out at the same
exactly.
time.
Right? Yeah.
And yeah, you've got your totalitarian government and like dystopian future, but this one was definitely more focused on that, like the suppressing of the emotions and the impact that it can have on society, right? In this movie, they're arguing that whether it's good feelings, bad feelings, anger, joy, whatever, it'll always eventually lead to war, right, to them. So it's a unique concept, and that's always stuck with me. I just love it for that.
Alan, how about you?
Yeah, playing with the whole, like, this is definitely like an anime infused movie, so I would definitely like want to get your feel of it.
I remember my buddy was like, bro, you ever heard of Gunkata? And then that's how I got into it. I was like, whoa, yeah, I saw this.
They told me about that in Dare.
Yeah, they're like, suppress your feelings, here's a gun. Kicks some ass. But yeah, no, I saw this, I think roughly around the same time you guys were saying, like around Batman Begins. I was kind of like prepping myself because I was like, all right, who's this Christian Bale guy? All right, you know, I saw American Psycho and I was like, okay, I dig that. And then yeah, I got into Equilibrium and I was like, whoa, this movie's super sick. And even rewatching it, there's like a sequence where he's like interrogating one of the rebels and like he like throws him on a table. And I was just like, oh, there's Batman. Cool. But yeah, no, I definitely dug it a lot. I just really like more the action aspect of it. I like dystopian stuff, but I was kind of more in it for like the action, because you know what, nowadays we don't get that. I mean, we do with like the fast movies and you know, every now and again, but I feel like back then there was like a special type of action flick. And what I like too is that we brought this up before on previous shows, where we're not really getting a lot of like just straight, you know, movies that are like an hour to 30 minutes to 45 minutes kind of thing. Like that's kind of the sweet spot, and I like that this movie was able to encapsulate a great story, a great world building, action, everything all at once, And it was like a nice like time frame. We're not getting that as much anymore, you know. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love, you know, long, you know, movies, 2.5 hours, 3 hours, and all that, but sometimes it's nice to just pop on a flick and just give it a watch. But yeah, this definitely was a super, super sick movie when I saw it. And then rewatching it even now, I was like, oh man, this is like, I always forget how good it is. I'm like, holy shit. And like my girlfriend, she walked in and she immediately sat down and was like, all right, I'm watching this. Like it pulled her in immediately. So yeah, definitely a fun flick. And I really, really like this flick.
Nice.
So Derek, I think it warners itself to being able to world build very quickly because of its predecessors of dystopian, you know, like you see dystopia. Okay. You know what you're on board with. You can grasp the, you know, the grayness, the bleakness of the world, because it's like, yeah, I've seen this before. I read this before. So I think, and going back to like how we haven't really seen like these half hour or an hour and a half, 1 hour, 45 minutes is like, might be a little bit of like the underutilizing too of that. Use like a theme or a setting that has been done before, but like, yeah, like use that as your base point and build off of it. It's kind of thing too.
Yeah, no, I think you can really see the influences in this movie. They're, you know, it's wearing it's them right on its sleeve. Like you guys have mentioned, obviously this came out not too long after The Matrix, and everybody's got the guns and they're like doing the martial arts and they're all wearing these like black uniforms. Also, of course, the great dystopian fiction that, you know, you touched on, 1984 being a big one, Fahrenheit 451. Of course, I'd throw The Giver in there as well with the kind of suppressing of emotions and all that. And overall, I think, because I didn't see this movie a little bit later after you guys. I saw this movie when I was in college. And, you know, I was like a jaded college kid and I was just, this movie's so dumb, you know, but like, you know, at the time I was just like too cool for it. Cause I was like, this movie's from 2002, whatever. But, you know, considering that my last pick was also a 2002 light sci-fi Christian Bale starring action film, I am no one to judge. But because overall I would say that this movie to me felt like, and I mean this in absolutely like with no shade in the best possible way, this movie feels like what a 13-year-old boy would think is the coolest thing in the world. And it's just so fun in that aspect of just like, what if I invented a cool form of martial arts where you also use guns? And like, I read that the director invented Guntana in his backyard and I was like, that tracks, that checks so much sense, because this movie is just feels like, yeah, somebody, like a teenage boy, was like, I'm going to write this thing and it's going to be like, look like Fritz Lang's Metropolis because I saw that movie and it's going to have all these cool influences. And from that mindset, I was just not looking at it as like a cynical teenager, but looking at it now, just I can appreciate it for what it is, as this big, fun, ridiculous action movie that is actually drawing on some real literary classics. And beneath all of that kind of fun fluff stuff, the kind of over the topness of it, it is still doing some really good stuff. That it is saying some, you know, it does have all those themes about suppressing your emotions and government control and stuff that has become more and more relevant as we are slipping more into a dystopian world. So yeah, I had a blast watching it this time. You know, I still, you know, I might not make my one a list of all-time great movies for me, as my a friend of mine is fond of saying, it wasn't Ibsen, but not everything has to be this. You can still just be like, let's watch Christian Bale do some gun kata and kill some guys, and you know who doesn't want that?
I think you expressed it perfectly. I think I remember when I read Fahrenheit 451, right? And then our teacher, I wish our teacher had shown us this movie instead, but they showed us the 1960.
Oh no, not that one. That's a horrible version of 1984 or Fahrenheit 451. I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't make sense that why his wife and the girl are played by the same actress.
Exactly. And I remember she like told us like, it's gonna be a little bit weird. It's the same actress plays two people, and like it just didn't hit. And then I think though, like, in my mind, as we were reading and, then as we watched that version of it, I was like, this could be a cooler concept. I love it. It's my favorite book, but like, I think like we need a remake of this, right? And I think what you said, Derek, like this is definitely my 15-year-old self being like, I'm taking Fahrenheit 451. I'm adapting it, but with guns, with awesome action sequences, with trying to explain the efficiency of why shooting guns this way and this way and that way is efficient, right? What do they say? It increases your proficiency by like 125%. So like, yeah, 100%. It is just that. It is just a fun flick where it's got some awesome action sequences. Very different in the sense that like, during this time, everyone was kind of spoofing The Matrix, right? Like, it had such an impact on cinema and the choreography of action sequences, whereas this one didn't really necessarily, like, pick up on the slow motion aspect of it, right? So it's
the opposite direction.
Yeah, so I think it is that. It's just a fun flick with a lot of influences, and that's what we have.
And then one other thing, too, that I was really noticing this time around watching it is that I really like that Christian Bale is just an empath. And that is why he is so good
at intuitive. He's intuitive.
OK, well, I'm going to call him an empath. And that's why he's so good at the beginning. He's so good at both being like someone who can understand how others are feeling when he is hunting them down, but also can relate and slip into the resistance so easily. Because, you know, at the beginning, like there's that whole scene where they're like, well, how do you know people know what they're feeling? And he doesn't understand feelings yet, but he still has that in him where he is able to relate to other people's emotions and understand them so well, even with his feelings being suppressed, that he's like, oh, I know that this person's feeling this. I know that they're doing this and this and this. And then that all comes around full circle. He stops taking the drug. He starts feeling things again. And he's like, oh, man, this is the greatest thing. So I thought that through line, that piece of his character, where he is so just emotionally resonant with everyone around him and is able to understand other people's emotions and how that at the beginning is a tool used against the people, which is then turned into a weapon for them at the end, was such a cool progression for that character.
I would say actually, like, because so I've been like thinking about this like for like an idea that I've been thinking about, but like the difference between intuition and empathy, like there is a fine line, and where I think that the reason why they chose intuitive instead of empathy is because empathy feeling is needed for empathy. So I would say that, like, kind of like he probably, because deep down he was empathetic, he had increased intuition, and it was this like progression of the intuition actually being empathy, and then once the like the literal floodgates of not taking your medication, like it shows his actual full pure empathy. And so like I would even say that even like that, like the whole reason why they called them intuitive instead of empathetic might be because of that reason. And it is definitely like, it's cool to, if you think about it that way, because further suppression of how you are actually, you know, as a person, like the, to explain like empathy is like, no, you're just intuitive. It's kind of like even removing like the feeling of feeling or emotion from even that. Like, it's just like it increases that like facade of being emotionless and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I think what I'm hitting is like, I do think I would call him empathetic because they are suppressing that, but that is still in him, you know, that is still that innate empathy, while he doesn't know how to express it or what it even means with him and people. And it even makes his superiors a little bit suspicious of him he doesn't really know how to express it or what that part of him is until later on in the movie, and that empathy really comes out.
Yeah, I think I like that. I think that he is empathetic, but the society they encourage the intuitiveness mm-hmm. of their cleric, right? Mm-hmm. They encourage that, and they're looking for future and potential individuals that can have that ability. But they've branded it and marketed it as you're intuitive, not empathetic, mm-hmm. even though exactly. it requires that, right? It requires for and we see that with Christian's character. He is empathetic, he builds on top of that. But society has distorted and tarnished emotions in general that, no, we're not calling it we're not calling mm-hmm. you guys empaths, right? We're calling you an intuitive group. So it's interesting. I love that. And I think even that poem that Sean Bean reads to him, right? At the beginning.
Incredible.
It's so good, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the, I think I wrote it down. It's the wishes for the cloths of heaven, right? And mm-hmm. it's read by William Butler Yeats, and mm-hmm. and essentially it's just a poem about like this profound desire to offer something magnificent and beautiful to, in this case, the writer to his beloved, right? And that individual is imagining, you know, the possessing of these heavenly fabrics, right? Had I had the heavens embroidered cloths and wrought with golden and silver light, the blue and the dim and the dark cloths of night and light and half the light, I would spread the cloths under your feet. But I, being poor, have only my dreams. And then I have spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly because you tread on my dreams, right? And I think that last part, right, tread softly because you're treading on my dreams. I think that's where that empathy in Christian's character really kicks in, right? Mm-hmm. It's in there, it's suppressed, but when Sean says like, I'm offering you and all I have are my dreams, be careful with them. My dreams, my hopes, my desires of wanting you to feel what I feel, that's all I have. And so I think that's where that empathy kicks in. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, that poem like literally represents true vulnerability, and with vulnerability means like, you know, like true and most natural and pure emotion. And that's why that it just hits you in the core, like with that thing of like that is it's pure vulnerability. And that's like what the society has robbed its citizens of, like of having that pure that pure love when it comes down to it, of the emotion and of like just having that feeling of connection, whether it be with, you know, a significant other or with just a friend, just that removal and the purity of just human connection. And that's what that poem essentially represents, kind of.
Yeah.
Now, well, you guys hit every nail on the head, so you guys kind of beat me to the punch. But yeah, you guys have all said it incredibly eloquently. So you guys have, well, knocked it out of the park. I don't know what to say.
I was just gonna say, I think you bring up that lack of connection with a person, or you know, with whoever, but like, there's also that lack of connection, obviously, in this movie with art. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you said, Derek, with what's happening, you know, in our current mm-hmm. society, like I think it stood out to me more now that using art as a form of rebellion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
and it's such a, whether it's using the poem, whether looking at the Mona Lisa as it burns, there's this power in music, in literature, that can evoke these emotions. But yeah, that lack of connection with individuals or even with art, I think it's portrayed very well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say this is my second favorite movie where the Mona Lisa burns up. I won't say what the other one is because it's a spoiler. Yeah, I think you know that all leads really well into something that I was thinking about, which is throughout the movie, you see everything is this gray, very concrete, reminiscent of like the underworld in Metropolis kind of vibe. And they shot this in Germany, you know, to utilize all the East German, very like the construction there. It's all just very minimal and just blocks and everything. But then there's that moment when he is starting to feel things and he wakes up and hears the rain. And I'm just like, I'm somebody who like loves the rain. Hearing the rain on the window, and he tears away that, you know, shade or whatever that is like stopping the outside world. And he like looks at it and it's like, wow, this guy has been surrounded by this, like, you've only been seeing this gray, dull, formless future, but it's like, wow, seeing that sunrise and the Zeppelin coming, it's like, they made a dope fucking future world, and he didn't even realize it, and we didn't even realize it in the audience, so it's so cool, because he's having that moment of, wow, this looks so fucking cool, and I never noticed, at the same time that we, watching it, are having that reaction, and it really ties into everything you were saying about appreciating art and appreciating the natural world and all of that.
I think that scene stood out to me the most this time around. Like, he starts scratching off the film on the window there, right? And but you're mm-hmm. right. I think I'm always caught up with like the production design of this movie and how like how blank it is. But it is a cool future. It is a cool aesthetic that they created as the filmmakers and as the production design and set design. But like, we don't appreciate it until that scene, which is like, I don't know, like 40 minutes into the movie. And I like that we're having that same experience as Preston with him as he's scratching off that film off the window. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, no, it just comes with the whole like metaphor of rain itself and the washing away and like it, just the symbolism of that. Just like, yeah, like water creates like a new beginning and things like that. So it's just that scene is a very beautiful scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think one of my favorite little scenes, since we're talking about art, you know, he's never really had the opportunity to express himself in any way. And, you know, because of the things they have to take and everything. And I think one of my favorite little small moments in this movie is the rearranging of the desk mm-hmm. of him mm-hmm. because like we all do it. I mean, all of us in our own workspace or in our homes, you know, we arrange things the way we want them. And you can see, like, I'm not going to lie, the more and more I think about it, I really love Christian Bale's performance in this film, especially because like, I like his gradual kind of change throughout. Like, he's so stern and just emotionless, and then little by little there's these like little instances of him. I mean, it's plainly obvious, but I think that was my favorite little moment of him like figuring out a way to finally express himself. And it's something so small as just rearranging your desk, moving things. And then I love that when the other cleric shows up and he's like, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, it's just for optimum performance. Yeah. You know, I just want to make sure everything. And I'm like, that's fucking hilarious. That was a great save, but I feel like anybody would have been like, oh, okay, sure. But yeah, I think that was a great little moment because I think everybody in general loves to express themselves in any fashion. Even people who are like, well, I'm kind of boring and I don't really know. There's something, even just something as simple as like a mug, like their favorite mug that they drink the coffee out of the morning. I don't know. I really, really dug that.
Yeah, that all those like little droplets of like of him like changing or switching things up, running around and stuff like that. I guess I had forgotten like of that little line at the end by you know the chancellor, whatever he is. But I was like, how are you not like getting like they're gonna catch you? You're acting like you're like literally acting out and things like that. But then it like ended up being all by design. Like they knew all along kind of thing. But it even that kind of adds like an enjoyment to the story as well, of just the cat and mouse kind of thing of element as well added to it.
Do you guys think that, and maybe this was just me, but like I was watching Taye Diggs' performance, but like, was he?
He was off. He had emotions.
Yeah, right. Like
the Chancellor had emotions. Yeah.
Yeah, he kept smiling. I was like, why is he smiling so much?
Because it like he was a plant. He was a little plant from the beginning. Mm. You know, they wanted to use and manipulate Christian Bale's character. I would think that they had this planned since his wife, you know, essentially. Right. And because he didn't catch on. So there is something like deep within him that was susceptible to, you know, essentially starting to like follow suit with his wife of rebelling. So I think that this, it was just like a very long con of, mm-hmm. of, for him of, yeah, they like try to use him, but he got the best of them in the end. Like he, and that's mainly just because he's like, he's well trained kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So Ariel, so are you saying that Taye Diggs' character was never on Prosium?
I don't think he was. No, I think similar to how the Chancellor was. Yeah. I think he was a plant from the beginning. That's why literally like he says it the first time that they meet, and then he repeats it twice after of like, I'm going to make my career off of you. Like, because he knew he was going to make his career off of him by essentially helping with this ploy to use them as a tool to get the resistance.
I like that you pointed that out, because I think this last time I was just like, he's too charming and charismatic. Like, I like
it. Right?
Like, he's so good, but like, why isn't Prosium working on him? It almost feels like it wasn't. But no, I like that, because then, yeah, it is long con, and it's just playing him for the long run just so they can exploit him. So, yeah, I like, thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, no, and Ariel, that's a really good point, because that also brings up another really interesting parallel is, you have the guy in charge, and you have his kind of like right-hand man, like the muscle, the Darth Vader, the dragon, whatever, of the, you know, the evil regime. And it's the, while they are keeping everyone below them unemotion, they have no emotion. They are like, well, we're in charge, so we have to have emotions. The exact opposite is what the William Friedman character is saying. He's saying like, oh, so that everyone can have emotions, we can't. Me, the leader, and you are, you're going to be like my right hand man and go and be like my agent. You can't have emotions. So it's an interesting parallel between those two, the two factions, where it's like, yeah, we're fighting for these different ideologies, but we, as the people leading this, are going on the exact opposite of that. So I think that's very fascinating.
I mean, it's just the society that has always existed, in my opinion. Of essentially the higher up say like, yeah, no, we're suffering the same amount, but no, they don't. They have they are well off. They, you know, they have society. I mean, they get to indulge, and they're not suffering, you know, kind of thing. The ones that have the most resources to suffer a bit aren't the ones that suffer. And so it's just definitely, yeah, like it just follows suits, and it just like it more further extends how this movie reflects, you know, society in all.
No, that's also a really good catch.
Also, if you take a look at the end of the final boss fight, my girlfriend actually pointed this out. She was like, he's wearing white when everybody's wearing black. Mm-hmm. Yin and yang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Going back to that point, Ariel, that you brought up of the rain, right, symbolizing a rebirth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Him wearing that white of symbolizing, you know, like he's a new person, a reborn, so to speak. So yeah, no, good call out. Yeah,
yeah, and that's another, I would say, with all the rain stuff, and it just it's another showing another one of its influences in Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah, no, definitely, like especially with Blade Runner 2049. Of that feeling, like I just feel like at some point they're gonna like go into a room and like go through different questions, like, and say acknowledge, like,
yeah,
and
I was expecting to do that and, that test, yeah, with, yeah. Like I was expecting someone to be like, you flip a turtle on its back, you know.
So question for you guys, why do you think that other dystopian, so I mean shortly after this, within like a decade, we start getting like The Maze Runner and like all these other,
love Maze Runner.
Whether it's Hunger Games, whatever it is, right? We get all of these additional like dystopian movies, yeah, adaptations from a book, but like what made those be more in the zeitgeist than like an Equilibrium?
The ones that you listed off are very like, they're young adult.
Yeah.
And but are you talking more about like a fantastical element or just like kind of like of
I think he means why is it that Equilibrium wasn't as big at the time and why are these films bigger now?
Yeah. Yeah, I think like one because they were like age group wise again, you know, kind of thing of like this was like when essentially, it is grabbing the people that like Maze Runner, Hunger Games, Divergent were the age of, you know, kind of thing. Like, you know, that's the age that I started to read those books as well, was around this the age that I watched Equilibrium, you know, kind of like a generation that is coming up now in society. And because even before this, like, dystopian movies hadn't hit its mark just yet. Like you said, like Fahrenheit 451 wasn't like the greatest. 1984, that movie adaptation was like a niche one. Other alien dystopian movies were kind of like in the zeitgeist at the time when Equilibrium kind of came out. I think you were coming out of like, you know, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and like what was Soylent Green? That kind of like those kind of movies and things like that. So I think maybe that kind of thing. And then also overall, it's Dimension Studio, right? Is the one that produced this. They didn't really produce, the majority of their movies didn't get that much like notoriety.
Scream
was the breakout. But even Scream is a niche movie, you know?
Like, I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
Well,
but sorry, go ahead.
but yeah, like I guess Scream is like one of the only few. But then also, yeah, maybe because of the whole Matrix of it all, kind of like seeing that is like, yeah, that's highly computer graphic comparatively to this. This one's a lot more practical in a way. And so seeing it might have been seen as like kind of a knockoff of Matrix, like as it was mistakenly, you know, associated with, which I don't agree that with it like being associated with the Matrix. I think it's I like this movie a lot better than the Matrix.
Oh, wow. And I think to build off, I think there's two reasons. And the first one, I think it lines up with you're saying, Ariel, about like the demographic, like the age group of this. Because I think that teens, YA fiction stuff like that, if you are going to wake up to the crazy totalitarian regime and just all the bullshit that's going on, you're more likely to do it in the age range that would be set. Like, there's not a lot of people that are middle-aged that are just waking up one day and being like, you know what, I think that I'm gonna start waking up to like all the horrors around me after being complicit with it. You're much more likely to, you're still being molded kind of into the person you are when you're a teenager, and so that may be why you line up with more of like, identify more with like Katniss Everdeen than, you know, Christian Bale's character in this. But I think the other reason why a lot of these started to hit in that time frame from like, you know, a couple of years after this is because this came out in 2002. So we were still very early in the Bush regime. Mm-hmm. I think that once we were really into it, once people, because people were still kind of like high on like his whole poll numbers were pretty good. But then people like a couple years later were like, hey, you know, the Patriot Act, that thing that's surveilling us, it's pretty messed up. And I think that like that kind of totalitarian, those vibes started to kind of permeate more in. And that's why some of the things that came out a couple years after this, 05, 06, 07, 08, really resonated with people because people had kind of come down off that high of like, we're America, we're going to go kick ass, to like, this isn't great. So I think it was a big timing thing.
I kind of wanted to jump on what Derek was saying. Yeah, a big part of it. I think also too, 9/11 was pretty fresh. Mm-hmm. And I know 9/11 had affected a lot of stuff, especially anything that was like, I don't want to say dark,
it's
but
the
like
patriotism of it all.
Yeah. Like I think it kind of hit a little weirdly where like, I think the year after 9/11 and maybe even after that, there was a very like, you have to be careful with what you say, you know, what you want to see, you know, networks and studios were pushing things out. I mean, how many, you know, films have like scenes that were edited or posters changed, you know, mm-hmm. Lilo and Stitch, Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. So I think it was just one of those where I don't remember this film being advertised heavily. Mm-hmm. I think I remember it being advertised as like, oh, it's like The Matrix.
Yeah.
Like Marcel was saying earlier, but yeah. And then I think, like Derek, you were saying later on, you know, all these things started happening in politics. And there was just a massive influx of like popularity in YA, and a lot of YA novels are pretty much dystopian stories. And now if you look at the early 2010s, we were, you know, as much as now we're filled with comic book films, I remember the early 20s, even late 2000s, there was so many of like dystopian films, television shows, everything. And I think also too, I don't know if it's like, I don't know how to say, but like, I feel like maybe that was our generation. Like that was our, because I was a teenager at the time, like, you know, when a little after this movie came out and all those books and films started coming out. So I feel like you said, it was the perfect time for everybody to start feeling that, like, you know, and you're a teenager, so you immediately are ingrained to rebel. So that's something that catches your attention immediately. And I think that's what just kind of took over, and I think Equilibrium just was a little late. Well, I shouldn't say late. It was ahead of its time.
Yeah.
A little too ahead of its time before reaching it. And it isn't it always the way, you know, with all of these underrated films?
Yeah, and I do think, honestly, this film kind of has had a resurgence in popularity, because I don't remember anybody really speaking about it very highly even when I was in college. And then I went on like Letterboxd to just kind of see, like, expecting people to be like trashing it and stuff like that. And it doesn't have like a great, but it's got like a 3.3. That's better than a lot of movies. That's like above average. So I think people have, like a lot of the films that we've talked about, started to really come back around to it. And I think it, yeah, is because, like you said, Alan, it did probably just come out a little bit too early before that people were appreciating all of these themes in it.
No, that's great. That's a great point. I think, yeah, I was that kid in junior high that I got introduced to Rage Against the Machine, you know, like in seventh grade. And while everyone else was listening to, I don't know, All American Rejects, I had my, you know, Evil Empire shirt from Rage Against the Machine. And so I think, like, for me, I think that's what it is. We as a society couldn't portray an Americanized, a North American society in a dystopian aspect and talk bad about it, right? Because we were all pro-America, you know, right after 9/11. And so I think you're right. Like, that movie just came out a little bit too early. Like, it came out too soon. And then it was marketed as, like, you know, better than The Matrix or whatever. And it has nothing to do with the themes as The Matrix. But I think that's what it was. Like, it came out too early. And we as society couldn't talk about, like, an evil government unless it was clearly marketed as a Middle Eastern country, right? In our media. That's the only way we could talk about evil governments at that time. So... Yeah.
And interestingly, I think, yeah, this is, now I'm thinking about it, like all the ones that we mentioned, the ones that got film adaptations, 1984, Fahrenheit 451, those are all set in England. This is really what, like, the first one, like you said, Marcel, that is an American totalitarian dystopia. Mm-hmm. At least that we saw on film and not on like a book form or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, before we wrap up, guys, any final thoughts on Equilibrium?
No, just like, if you're a fan of like the dystopian thing, it's a staple. It should be a staple for you because it just grasps it so well. And with such simplicity to it as well, because it is like, even the concept of being emotionless, like it's in itself just encompasses something that, like, you as a human do sometimes desire, but then it shows like the real cost of it, like going back to, like, yeah, what is the cost between feeling or and not feeling, you know, like what is the right thing to do. And then like, yeah, in the end, like you, and as you know, you kind of think to yourself, usually, hopefully, yeah, like feeling is a gift and is a lot better. It's a lot better to feel than to not feel.
I love that. And, yeah, I think for me, yeah, I think what stood out, and I touched briefly on this because of what's happening in our society, I think using art as a form of expression, rebellion even, it's so crucial, so important to have, to express that level of creativity, to emote these feelings, right? That it's better to feel than not feel, to better to have lost than not experience anything at all, right? I love it. If you haven't seen it, this is great. Go read Fahrenheit 451 and then watch this as its adaptation. Because it's so much better. But and hopefully one day we'll get a good Fahrenheit 451.
Is the Michael B. Jordan one any good? I didn't see that one.
I watched it.
Narrative. It's like it's not true to the book. That's okay. The thing is that it's not true to the book, so it's kind of like, like he had a perfect thing. Like Guy Montag doesn't have a wife. Yeah. They kind of take his story in a different direction, kind of thing. It is like more so like kind of similar to like the Evil Dead movies of it's a success. It's like a spiritual successor kind of thing than an actual like adaptation.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, it was well casted with Michael B. Jordan, Michael Shannon, right?
Yeah,
and super exciting in that sense. But then I think they took out those elements that really put Guy Montag on the path to his awakening. Yeah, it was just a bit of a bummer, but one day we'll get the one.
And Marcel, so sometimes during episodes at the end of the show, I like to ask just like a little fun question for everybody. And I wanted to ask, what is your guys's like, I mean, you guys have kind of mentioned Fahrenheit 451 and 1984, but what is like a, I guess, dystopian type of story that you would recommend to people?
So, yeah.
Like film-wise.
Film-wise, yeah.
I was going to say The Giver, but that movie is trash, so never mind.
I like The Giver. The book did it. I mean, the movie did okay, but the books are definitely, like, if you have not read the quadrilogy.
The Quartet, I think it's called on the box.
The Quartet, yeah. The Quartet, it's such a beautiful series. Like, I freaking love it. I think Gathering Blue is like one of my favorite books of all time.
Nice.
The movie wise, I like really truly, and I know it is based off a book, but the Maze Runner movie series did a really well job of adaptation. Like they did kind of cut off like the fat of the book that like you're like, yeah, didn't need that. It's a very really good cohesive, like, you know, a series. Has my guy Thomas and played by Dylan O'Brien, and I like that series. I have a soft spot for the Hunger Games movies. That did not as great, not the greatest of adaptations, did a pretty well job. Like I think I put Maze Runner a little bit higher than that, but yeah, the Hunger Games movies just have a soft spot for that. Kind of trying to think of like a serious dystopian movie. Like this one definitely. Yeah. Come back to me and I'll think of like a good serious dystopian movie.
I was thinking, I actually just, not just, but like 4 months ago, I rewatched The Hunger Games. And that first one is so good. Like I had forgotten how good the first one is. Like it's almost
first, second one are like, yeah, top notch.
Yeah.
And then like just because of like the changes that they made in Mockingjay Part 1 and 2, like you want more because the book had so much more in Mockingjay that it's like it's okay. It's good enough, but you wanted the more kind of things.
Yeah. And I think even the like this first one when I rewatched it was like probably my first time rewatching it in like, I don't know, 5 years. But like it's very like it's almost shot like an indie movie. Mm-hmm. Like it's very low budget, and it and Derek knows this. On our podcast, we always talk about like sitting with our emotions. Like it really like there's a lot of times where it's just quiet, and it's just you're just following Katniss, looking at her reactions, processing her emotions. But yeah, that one, and I was thinking Children of Men.
Children of Men, there you go. Yeah, That's a good one.
I mean, I was just gonna like mirror what you guys are saying, because anybody can see the video can see the kind of corner of it here. But I stole this from the movie theater when I worked there. I've got the Catching Fire thing on my wall. I do love the whole series. I mean, I also love both Mockingjay 1 and 2. I think all 4 films are really fantastic. I think that first one though is probably my favorite. It's Lawrence. Who's I know they're all. Lawrence. It's the only. What's his first name? But I can't
Francis.
Remember. Francis Lawrence.
Lawrence.
But like that first one is, you know, so good. It's got that handheld thing. I really think they're all incredible. I'm very, very excited for The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. I'm a huge, like I just devoured those books. So I'm just a huge fan of that entire series. You know, the year that it came out, 2012, the first one, it was... I wrote a little blog at the time, and I named it as my favorite film of the year, and that was a really incredible year for film. We've actually talked about a number of 2012 movies on this podcast. And I'll admit something that I haven't admitted on the podcast before. I actually did write some Hunger Games fan fiction, so I was all on board for that shit.
That's cool. Publish it on the website.
To be ashamed of. I've written fan fiction too. It's a really awesome form of art.
Thank you. probably one of the more popular things I've written. It was a lot of fun.
Well, my pick, I don't think you guys ever heard of it. It's this old movie. It's about like some kid where, you know, his uncle and aunt get killed by the government, and then some old hermit picks him up and he goes, "Hey, do you want to go take out these sons of bitches?" It's this movie called Star Wars. I don't know if you guys ever heard of it.
No, never heard of it.
Since you guys are all going Hunger Games, I'm going to have to go with the OG then. I'm going to have to go with Battle Royale.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
But is it really I haven't seen Battle Royale. I need to watch it. But is it really a dystopian like society around it? Or do they just like capture kids kind of thing?
No, it's a dystopian society around it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a great flick.
I need to watch it.
You'll see a lot. Maybe we'll cover it on this.
That's a good idea.
This one. But it also influenced a fucking plethora amount of Battle Royale games as well. So that's a big influence, apparently. But yeah, that'll be my pick is a Battle Royale. Plus, it's gorier.
Yeah, something also going games. Off of that, that like, Battle Royale and like kind of dystopian. Yeah, like at the start of a dystopia. Quote unquote, I'll leave it at that. But something I recently watched, and it's become like one of my favorite TV series of all time, is Alice in Borderlands. I cannot recommend that series so much, and that dystopian and that form of battle royale is so incredible in the story and just the ending. I think it has to be like one of my favorite endings of anything. It's in my top for sure. It's such a beautiful story from start to end. Really good.
I just want to correct myself real fast. I just double checked. Francis Lawrence was the guy who did all the Hunger Games except for the first one. The first one was Gary Ross.
That's right.
That was great, guys. I think coming out of this, I love it when I go into a podcast being maybe a little bit mixed on a movie, and just the discussion makes me have so much deeper of an appreciation. So like, which I think definitely happened here. I came out of this having such a more positive opinion, I think, than I did going in. So, which is why I love doing this stuff. But yeah, Marcel, where can people find you? Tell people about yourself and the Real Chumps.
Yeah, Real Chumps, we're a podcast where we're chatting about movies. Feels like hanging out with friends. And that's kind of what we want to do, is just have genuine, sincere conversations with our listeners. But you can find us on any platform, on Real Chumps. We're on Instagram, Twitter, at Real Chumps. You can follow me on Twitter at Marstrosity, MarzTrosity. My co-host, Danny, he's a director, video editor, has his own production company. So he's the one that provides the real insights, where I just come in and just kind of talk about my love for movies. So we have a unique dynamic in that sense. But yeah, give us a listen. And thank you so much for having us on, or having me on. This is a great movie to talk about.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Then, thank you so much.
Yeah, and then Ariel, do you want to mention your other podcast that you do as well?
Yeah, I do a podcast called You've Never Seen. It comes out at the start on the first of every month. So, there's always the back catalog. And then if you're close to the beginning of the month, expect that very soon. But yeah, go on, check that out. I have really awesome, deep discussions usually about things and things like that. And like, definitely usually always come out of finding a new thing about a movie series that I had just been introduced to, or my guest has just been introduced to, and we get our first impression on those movies.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun too. And then I will just mention too that I'm on one other podcast as well. Check out Can I Say Something that I do with my buddy Damien. He's the host. I'm just kind of the co-host there. I'm the color commentary, if you will. But we do a number of other things too here. Look up Undercast Company on all the social medias to find all our stuff. We've been playing around with TikTok. We started a short film review series over on TikTok called Microdose. It's also on our Instagram, on our YouTube as well. So check us out on all those places. And then check out our Patreon. We do some bonus podcasts for people who are our patrons. We have somebody who has... It's coming up soon. Once you're a patron for 6 months at the $5 level, you get to pick an episode for us. So we're going to be doing the first ones of those soon. We're about to hit the 6 months mark since we started that. But even if you just pay $1 a month, it makes a huge difference to us. We appreciate it so much. And then you get to hear us talk about some other cool stuff on our Undercast Film Club. But yeah, thank you, Marcel, once again. Thank you, Alan and Ariel. And thank you guys for letting me appreciate this movie in a much deeper way. So until next time, I'll see you guys all.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks for being amazing.
Take it easy, everybody.
I am having, this is crazy, but I'm having feelings again. Like some kind of 14-year-old kid or something. I mean, you remember feelings, right?
Yeah, I have feelings every single day of my life.
Do you?
Are you saying you don't have feelings?